after the international news.
Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, June 1st, 2023. The Biden administration imposes sanctions on companies owned by Sudanese leaders Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and General Hamdan Dagalo.
But I don't think that coming as they do 6 weeks or 7 weeks into the conflict, that they're necessarily going to get the attention or strike fear or get the generals, frankly, to change their calculus.
And activists in South Sudan discuss justice and accountability.
After deliberations, we have seen that all these mechanisms need a political will. But at the moment, there is no political will.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United States said today it is imposing economic sanctions and visa restrictions against Sudan as the latest ceasefire appears to be in tatters and talks between the two warring parties have collapsed. Washington had warned the warring parties, the army and the paramilitary support forces, of punitive actions if the truce was undercut by violence. U.S. National Security Advisor Jack Sullivan said the worsening situation raises concerns of, quote, protracted conflict and widespread suffering at the hands of the security forces, end of quote. Witnesses reported an increase in fighting early today in various parts of the capital, Khartoum, that included a rocket attack on a market that left at least 18 dead and over 100 wounded, the biggest single civilian death toll for a single incident since fighting began in April. World Food Program Chief Cindy McCain said food and other assets were being looted in El Obeid, a regional hub to southwest of Khartoum, adding, quote, food for 4.4 million people is at stake. Saudi Arabia and the United States have been monitoring the latest ceasefire deal, which was meant to run until Saturday evening. The truce brought some reduction in fighting and gave space for limited humanitarian relief, but has been marred by clashes and airstrikes that broke several previous ceasefires before they took hold. On Wednesday, the army announced it was pulling out of talks brokered by the U.S. and the Saudis. More than 1.2 million people have been displaced internally by the fighting, and an additional 400,000 have fled across the borders, the UN said Tuesday. At least 730 have been killed, according to official counts, but the real number are likely higher. Joining us live is VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell. Anita, welcome to this program.
Pleasure to be with you.
Anita, you attended a meeting this morning where the U.S. National Security Advisor Jack Sullivan made some significant announcements regarding sanctions on Sudan. Key amongst them is the economic sanction. What kind of economic sanctions is the Biden administration imposing on Sudan?
Sure. Just to clarify, that was an administration official who briefed us this morning, not Jake Sullivan. But as for the sanctions that you asked about, it's sanctions on four companies, two each by the combatant leaders, the leader of the SAF and the RSF. These are wide-ranging companies with their fingers in many pies, including the gold sector, manufacturing, and arms. The idea, of course, is to hamstring them so that they can no longer fund this violence, this unconscionable violence that's putting the Sudanese people in the middle. So those are the sanctions that were announced today and that were previewed, I want to say, a few weeks back when the administration kind of gave themselves the leverage to impose these sanctions and kind of threatened them. Now the time has come and they've slapped on those sanctions.
And there was a talk of, visa restrictions. Are there any names of people who could be targeted with these visa restrictions?
Well, I'm sure we can guess the names, but officially, State Department policy is that visa sanctions are private. So we don't know exactly who personally these sanctions are targeting and who is and is not allowed to travel to the United States. But I think it's a very reasonable guess to say it's people who are high up on the totem pole in both of these combatant organizations.
And when I was reading through the statements that were released, there was a talk of releasing an updated business advisory on Sudan. Could you explain that to the ordinary citizens who don't understand these technical terms?
So a business advisory is sort of fleshing out why, in short, you should not do business with these people. It is basically, to really dumb it down, it's a little bit like in the movie Mean Girls, where the girls do a burn book and they talk about, you know, why you shouldn't trust so-and-so. This is just kind of spilling the tea on these organizations and warning investors and U.S. related companies why they should not do business with these people, because they are responsible for a number of serious crimes, because they'll be funding this unconscionable violence and so on. But I think what's important to remember is that Washington here doesn't have a whole bunch of leverage over Khartoum. This is why, and I asked about this, you know, I asked the NSC spokesperson, you know, what congressional action are you considering? And they kind of hedged on that, because at the end of the day, Washington and Khartoum do not have close relations. This is going to come down to regional actors like the African Union, IGAD, and again, probably the Saudis, to work through a solution with these intransigent generals.
Thanks, Anita. That's Anita Powell, VOA's White House correspondent, speaking to us about sanctions imposed on entities in Sudan. The United States Department of Treasury released names of four sanctioned companies affiliated with Sudan's warring parties. Two of the companies, Al Junaid Multi Activities Limited and Tridive General Trading Company, are associated with paramilitary leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo and his family, while Defense Industry Systems and Sudan Master Technology are controlled by the Sudan Armed Forces. The White House also announced visa restrictions against actors perpetrating violence in Sudan. These announcements came one day after the army withdrew from ceasefire talks with the paramilitary support forces in the Saudi city of Jeddah. Nabil Biagio spoke with Cameron Hudson, senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, to understand the significance of the move and its impact on the warring parties.
We certainly picked the right companies to target. These are companies that are at the heart of the military corporate establishment. But I don't think that coming as they do 6 weeks or 7 weeks into the conflict, that they're necessarily going to get the attention or strike fear or get the generals, frankly, to change their calculus about this war. It feels a bit like a warning shot, but that warning shot is coming well into the conflict already. So I'm not quite sure what the impact is going to be, if any, on the warring sides.
And in terms of economic interests and assets that can be affected by the sanctions and the visa restrictions, some people say, for example, Dagalo wouldn't care much about U.S. sanctions. His interests are with Russia and the Gulf countries and Libya. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what was not announced with this was a diplomatic strategy for how they see these sanctions being pursued and applied. I think without the cooperation of countries like the UAE, where some of these countries have their corporate headquarters, then I think there's no chance of these having any kind of impact. So certainly with Russia, I don't think Russia will be dissuaded at all. So some of the businesses and some of the countries that are already doing business with these entities, I think that they're unlikely to be dissuaded from continuing their work. But with countries like UAE, which have presumably been a U.S. ally and presumably the U.S. has an open channel of communication with, if they can't get them to equally apply these sanctions, then I think there's probably very little hope that they're going to have an impact.
And with regard to the military, the U.S. would also want an ally like Egypt to cooperate. Is that correct?
Well, presumably, yes. I think that, if no one takes these sanctions seriously, if they continue to do business with these corporations, then I think there's going to be very little impact. And frankly, anybody who's going to be doing business with entities that are already at war and where they've already had a military junta overthrow the government, they're clearly, I think, not worried about the reputational risk or even the potential legal risk of doing business with these entities. So we have sanctioned, I think, what looks like low-hanging fruit. That's still important to do, but I don't think that we should expect there to be a shift in the war effort as a result of this.
The announcement did not include names or any specific individuals targeted with sanctions. Can we surmise that the two top generals, Burhan, the army chief, and Dagalo, the RSF commander, are targeted directly?
No, we can't surmise that they've been targeted directly. I think that this feels like a warning shot to them. On the RSF side, the companies that have been targeted are at the heart of the Dagalo family empire. And so I think that it is a warning shot to them. But I think the fact that none of the generals being targeted suggests to me that Washington continues to believe that those generals have a role to play in the political talks going forward, that they have a role to play in the Jeddah discussions. And I think that shows a kind of continuation of a misguided U.S. approach, where we continue to prioritize the military actors in a political conversation going forward. And until we decide that those actors are no longer legitimate in the political talks, and we would decide that by sanctioning them directly, then I think we hold open the possibility that they continue to play a role, which is very dangerous.
That's Cameron Hudson, Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio this past hour in Washington. Some civil society activists in South Sudan are calling on the government to prevent impunity and restore law and order in the country. The activists say the government should enact laws governing transitional justice mechanisms. For VOA News, Juliana Shiapai reports from Juba.
The African Union Commission inquiry in South Sudan, which investigated the crisis in South Sudan following the outbreak of war in 2013, recommended the establishment of an ad hoc African legal mechanism under the auspices of the African Union with the support of the international community to bring those who bear the greatest responsibility at the highest level to account. Some activists say South Sudanese who have suffered from several kinds of abuses want justice and accountability for crimes committed during the 2013 and 2016 when conflict erupted across the country. Zahra Said, the program officer for South Sudan Network for Democracy and Election, who spoke at the sidelines of a workshop on transitional justice and accountability mechanism in Juba earlier today, says several challenges face the transitional justice process in South Sudan.
After deliberations, we have seen that all these mechanisms need a political will. But at the moment, there is no political will. Time is running. The roadmap, we are running short of time, and we need to have all these mechanisms in place.
Chapter 5 of the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement requires the transitional government of the national unity to establish transitional justice institutions, including a commission for truth, reconciliation and healing, an independent hybrid court, and a compensation and reparation authority. Gordon Lam is executive director of the Juba-based Dialogue and Research Institute, or DRI. He says to ensure transitional justice mechanisms are implemented, South Sudanese leaders should show political will to end impunity and restore law and order in South Sudan by enacting the required laws.
The fact that there was a conference recently in Juba on transitional justice showed that the government also knows about the importance of transitional justice. And so what we ask from them is that to enact the laws that govern the Commission for Truth, Reconciliation and Healing, and the law that will establish the hybrid court and the reparation authority.
The laws required for the establishment of transitional justice institution are yet to be enacted. 2 weeks ago, the parties to the agreement held a conference aimed at paving the way for the formation of a commission for truth, reconciliation, and healing. Lam says his agency will work with other groups to educate the public about the transitional justice mechanism. He says as part of nation-building process, the public has right to learn how transitional justice works. Jacqueline Nasiwa, executive director for the Center for Inclusive Governance, Peace and Justice, says in order to achieve transitional justice in South Sudan, the opinion and concerns of the ordinary citizens should be taken into account.
How do we start preparing for the Commission for Truth, Healing and Reconciliation? How do we ensure that citizens safely participate in this process? Their protection remains very important. But for this to happen, we need to have them included, we need to have them participate, and we need to have their views incorporated in every step of the transitional justice mechanisms.
John William is a project officer at PACS Country Office. He says his office is supporting strengthening the civic engagement to enable civil society voice their concerns on issues like transitional justice.
Creating awareness among the communities and among the civil society structures at this particular time is very important. And when the information is disseminated widely, and people will begin to engage and many voices will be coming out.
The workshop on transitional justice and accountability mechanism was organized by the non-profit Dialogue and Research Institute with funds from PACS, a Netherlands-based NGO. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shiapai in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the French medical charity says viral disease are still a big problem in South Sudan. Find out why after the break.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The French medical charity Doctors Without Borders, known by the acronym MSF, says measles cases continue to rise across some parts of South Sudan since the National Ministry of Health declared an outbreak of the viral disease in December last year. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
South Sudan's Ministry of Health declared an outbreak of measles following a rise in the number of confirmed cases across the country in December last year. John Rumunu, the Director General for Preventive Health Services in the Ministry of Health, said 31 people died from the disease and 2,471 cases were reported in 22 counties across the country. Beatrice Martinez de la Fonte, MSF's project coordinator in Tweed County of Warabi State, says in a recorded message extended to this program that the number of new cases of measles continues to be recorded since last year.
South Sudan is a country highly impacted by the climate crisis, and the floods have been more intense here since 2019. In Tweed County, for instance, the combination of heavy flooding and also the conflict and the violence that started in February 2022 have forced people to live in crowded settlements, temporary camps, and this is increasing the risk of infectious diseases such as measles.
De La Fonte says MSF has treated 1,073 patients and vaccinated close to 1,600 children across the country against measles in the first 3 months of 2023.
With the road cut by the floods, the access for medical care is a big challenge, and mass vaccination campaigns are normally hindered. NGOs and other agencies, we have been doing efforts to increase the coverage, but some communities remain in very unsafe areas. So the NGOs and other organizations, we are unable to intervene because we have safety concerns.
There is no specific treatment for measles, but health experts say there are things you can do if you think you have come into contact with the disease. Mabior Kir, Chief of Planning and Information for the National Public Health Emergency Operations Center at the Ministry of Health, says efforts are underway to manage and control the spread of the disease across the country.
We have just launched a national vaccination campaign that is across 80 counties of South Sudan. For the people that are already infected, the Ministry of Health, together with the partners, manage them in the facilities that are located within the country. And for the people that are not yet exposed, this vulnerable population, especially children 6 to 59 months, they are vaccinated.
South Sudan's National Minister of Health says the highest number of measles cases were recorded in Juba, Mbolo, Awerial, Pariang, Kapoita South, and Bor South County in Jonglei State. According to the World Health Organization, more than 140,000 people died from measles in 2018, mostly children under the age of 5 years, despite the availability of a safe and effective vaccine. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaideng in Bor.
From Bor, we move to Nigeria, where an estimated 25 million Nigerian citizens are living with various forms of disabilities and often feel marginalized. Nigeria enacted a disability law in 2019 to promote inclusivity, but disability rights groups say the law has not changed the status quo. However, a news organization is redefining inclusivity with a mobile news app for disabled. As Timothy Obiazo reports from Abuja.
When Eleonora Boyer gets to work every morning, she browses her phone for news stories. But with a visual impairment, she relies on voice commands to call up websites, and oftentimes she encounters difficulties.
I cannot access some websites or some applications with my screen reader, and which makes getting information very difficult.
Boyer's vision started deteriorating after birth, and she was later diagnosed with glaucoma. Some 25 million Nigerians are estimated to be living with disabilities and constitute one of the poorest segments of the population. Too often, they say, they are marginalized. But in May, a Nigerian online newspaper, The Cable, launched what it calls a Disability Inclusive News Application, or DINA, to give people with visual impairments access to information through a built-in talkback function. Boyer says the app has been helpful.
When I downloaded it and went through it, it was really good. It was accessible for me. My screen reader could use it. And also, I saw that some of the prints were very bold, which is also accessible for, you know, persons who are visually impaired but not totally blind.
DINA is considered Nigeria's first disability-friendly news application and was selected as one of the winners of the Google News Innovation Challenge in 2022. Kolakbo Olakboju is an editor at The Cable.
We fight for persons with disabilities as, you know, media stakeholders. We do so through our reports, through some of the advocacies that we do. However, we also forget that we have to actually provide solutions for them. And we move past the era of traditional media. We are in the era of digital media.
Stephen Idoko, a program manager at the Abuja-based nonprofit Inclusive Friends Association, says the news app should also help people who are deaf and need captions.
This kind of innovation shouldn't just be limited to the blind. We should also try to factor other cluster of disabilities into play. It is important that alternative images are provided in such publications online for the deaf.
Nigerian authorities signed the Disability Bill into law in 2019 after many years of advocacy and protest by disability rights groups. But critics in Nigeria say the law has yet to be properly implemented. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The Kenyan government says it has entered or plans to enter labor agreements with Canada, Germany, the United States, and certain countries in the Gulf area. The agreements aim to ease the path for Kenyans to work overseas, but advocates for workers' rights say such agreements, especially with Gulf countries, leave workers vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenya hopes an estimated 750,000 citizens who cannot find work inside the country can find employment overseas. The government says it intends to sign at least 10 bilateral labour agreements with other nations, including Gulf countries, in an effort to ease the unemployment burden.
People are moving constantly. So the government of Kenya is giving a priority to labour migration, labour mobility, and that is why, one, we have signed bilateral labour agreements with a few countries, and also we proposed to a number of countries the bilateral labour agreements that will govern the export of labour.
Cecilia Wanjiku is joining over 170,000 other Kenyans already employed in the Gulf region. The government says nearly half of them are domestic workers. Wanjiku says she's leaving Kenya to work as a housekeeper in Saudi Arabia.
And since I cannot acquire a good job in Kenya, that is where I decided to go to Saudi, somewhere far from my country, to just look for at least a good job that is going to cater for all my needs while I'm here, where, for the people who are in Kenya, for my family.
Kenya received around $4 billion in remittances from its citizens abroad in 2022, and the government aims to triple that figure through these new labour agreements. However, advocates say desperation for jobs has exposed Kenyan immigrants to abuse from employers overseas. In 2021 alone, 41 Kenyans died while working in Saudi Arabia, according to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Some rights activists say recruitment agencies in Kenya are not doing enough to protect and prevent the exploitation and abuse of workers. Peace Mutheu, who runs a recruitment agency in Nairobi, says many of the young women she sent abroad have run into trouble with employers.
For the last 2 years, I've defended 26 girls. 10 are back here in the country. 16, they have changed the employer. And by so doing, that is how I was affected.
Mutheu says Saudi agents have now blocked her from accessing the system, which lists job opportunities for young Kenyans. Faith Shimila worked in Saudi Arabia for a year and a half and returned with a scar in 2021. Shimila described brutal working conditions and abuse.
I used to work 18 to 19 hours, no medication, no resting hours, no leave, no breaking like you need to break, no, and leftover, that was what I was provided with. And where I was sleeping, poorly placed to sleep. And I was raped in all that. I can't count how many times I was raped in Saudi, but for sure I was raped so many times with that employee.
Lawyer John Moriri represents Shimela and 12 others who have taken legal action against the Kenyan government, saying it failed to protect them.
Even in times of abuse, most of these victims call out to the government, please come to our help, but the government does not assist or offer any form of assistance.
The center has asked the court to prohibit Kenyans from traveling to Gulf countries until their safety and rights are guaranteed. The Kenyan government says bilateral agreements with Gulf countries will offer workers protection from abuse, but critics remain skeptical. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday. We now leave you with a Lokoya traditional dance, and the song is Dodo. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Patrick Dare, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us again for another exciting edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
I'm not the one who's running out of time.